Well, you could just artificially create something by just saying arse for no good reason.
That is true. No.
It's a bit obvious though, isn't it?
A bit like your ass. Bit.
Come on, you're better than that. You're better
than
that.
I am a lot better than that. We're not better than that at the start.
Unless.
Do you want to hear the music?
Yeah, go on then.
Welcome to the Gaps in Knowledge podcast. I'm Reese, and I'm a geographer that knows nothing about history.
I'm Will. I'm a historian who knows nothing about geography.
And in this week's episode, I fall over felling in the forest, quiz Will on quirky quarters, and spend the rest of eternity measuring the coastline.
I get gas, I have bad times in the Balkans, and then I insult the British monarchy. Enjoy!
Yeah, wow. Okay, here we go. So, Will, we're going to go straight into misconception corner. Is it for me to start this time?
Yes.
It's been such a while, actually. I think
it has been a while. Yeah. Should we tell people why it's been a while?
Yeah, let's tell the boys and girls why it's been a while.
Yeah. So we had half term, which was lovely. That's not why it was a while. What did you do over half term?
So over half term, I pretty much, I managed to get gout and then had to be put in bed for a while and I couldn't walk around. So that was quite painful.
It's all the pheasant and port dinners you've been doing.
Exactly, again. Yeah.
Lucky you. But that's all cleared up.
Yeah, what about you? Well, yeah, it has cleared up. I was going to ask, what about you and your half term? I think your half term was probably a bit better than mine. To a certain extent.
It certainly started off better, yeah, because number one, I didn't get gout. And number two, I went on my honeymoon to Iceland, which was fantastic. Mm-hmm. As I'm sure you know, how many times have you been to Iceland?
Four times I've been to Iceland.
Four times. Uh-huh. So I'm catching up on you. That was our second time to Iceland.
Nice.
But we made the interesting honeymoon choice at the end of the holiday to both get COVID. Luckily, right at the very end. And luckily, my symptoms weren't, I didn't know I had it until I got back to Germany. So I had 1 week in Iceland on honeymoon. And then when we were supposed to be recording, I was in bed with COVID and then had 2 weeks recovering from COVID. And now here we are.
Okay. Shall we go straight into misconception corner?
Let's do it.
Okay. So I'm going to start this week. I think it was you that started last time, but who cares? It was long ago. I don't think anyone's going to notice that.
Nope.
But my question to you this week is, what is the main cause of deforestation?
Main cause of deforestation is, now, would you like the arsehole answer or would you like a proper answer?
I would like to actually hear both. So start with the arsehole answer to begin with.
The main cause of deforestation is chopping down trees.
It is. That is mostly true, actually. I suppose you could go down the line of anthropogenic and physical felling of forests. I suppose it would be felling then. Answer. Yeah, because I suppose lightning strikes cause forest fires and so on. But is that deforestation? I suppose in its natural sense, yes.
kind of. I don't know. So like, as in, why do people chop down trees in the first place?
I think it's more questions aimed at, yes.
So I know beef is quite a big one. Mm-hmm. People love their beef and chopping down the Amazon for beef is quite a big problem. Mm-hmm. But then timber is used in so much construction and wood pellets used for making energy and paper. I'm going to go construction. I'm going to go timber for construction.
Construction is a good answer, but if you went down your first thought, your first line of thinking, you would be nearer the right answer. Mm-hmm. So I'm gonna build this one up rather than kind of give it away straight away.
Okay.
Most people think the misconception lies here. They usually is just logging, cutting down trees for construction and material. So people going out into the forest, cutting down trees, and then that is usually the main cause of deforestation. However, that's like the most iconic thing that when you think deforestation, that's what you think's happening, is people cutting down the trees to then sell for profit.
For the trees.
Yeah, for the actual, the physical product itself. And it's become the iconic symbol of forest destruction. So things like How Stuff Works, for example, claim that logging is the primary driver of this problem. But this myth that it's just logging for material has even worked its way into popular culture. There's an animated film you might have heard of called Fern Gully, The Last Rainforest from 1992. And it depicted a logging operation as the main existential threat to the forest, forest's adorable creatures. So it's that's kind of the image that people have, is these bad men come in and take away the trees and take away their homes so they could sell all the trees for profit. That only really sort of accounts for 10% of all deforestation worldwide.
Is wow, 10%?
Yeah, it's only 10%. When in fact, going down the kind of line that you went with, which is for you said for beef and for cattle farming to clear mm-hmm. the land, is actually more of the right direction. So agriculture in generally accounts for 80% of all deforestation in the tropics.
Wow.
And it was just
80%.
80%, yeah.
That's absurd.
So like, but the three main commodities that it's linked to is palm oil, soybeans mm-hmm. and beef, which is what you mentioned. So mm-hmm. actually, if you want to save the world but from deforestation, what you want to do is stop drinking soya milk, stop eating palm mm-hmm. oil, and become a vegetarian. And if you could do all mm-hmm. those three, you might be on track to at least on an individual scale somehow trying to save the rainforest.
And am I right in thinking that the vast majority of that soy isn't going into human beings, it's going into cattle?
Yes
I think that's the case. Yeah,
yes, it kind of like loops back in on itself.
Yeah. So if the rainforest was being destroyed to create soy for human beings, mm-hmm. then it would be a much, much reduced problem because you wouldn't then have to destroy it for the cattle.
Exactly. So, and yeah, on top of that as well, one of the things that the thing with deforestation is that it's what they call a feedback loop, in that mm-hmm. if you clear forest and then obviously, because it's a rainforest, what happens at 2 o'clock in the afternoon in the rainforest? It rains.
Forest.
Yeah, oh, forest. Yeah. But it rains. And when it rains, if you've got no tree coverage, the soil erosion increases. As a result of that, you wash away lots of nutrients on the top of the soil. And let's not forget that actually, even though the rainforest itself is really lush, on the actual ground surface of a rainforest, you have to, if you go more than like, let's say half a meter into the soil, suddenly the nutrients just diminish. They're gone. Actually, the soil quality in rainforest is not that good. It's because so many trees are fighting to get to the top of the canopy that they take all the nutrients. So as soon as you cut down trees and wash away those nutrients, trees can never grow there again. And then as a result, because they can't grow there again, it kind of like amplifies that problem. And when there's no rain, and therefore it doesn't even rain. So actually what you're doing, not only taking away the rainforest, you're reducing the amount of rainfall by deforesting as well. So it's kind of self-perpetuating. Which is a big threat to global forests around the world. Mm-hmm. But do you try actively to avoid things like palm oil? And I know you're vegetarian, but things like mm-hmm. this, have you thought about that before?
So the environmental factors do come into why I'm a vegetarian. That's certainly one of the reasons. Because if everyone were to not eat meat, then there would be a hell of a lot less methane and a hell of a lot more forests in the world. Mm-hmm. Palm oil is, it's kind of on my radar, but it's more the kind of thing that when I see a product with a logo saying palm oil free, I think, oh, that's nice, rather than it being at the forefront. Mm. Because it's the kind of thing that isn't as well known for deforestation style problems. I mean, you think of kind of destroying the climate of the orangutan and that kind of thing when it comes to palm oil. But there are so many issues around the global food chain that, I don't know, it just seems as though it's not one of the big ones. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. I happen to have been through a palm oil plantation in Sao Tome and Principe mm-hmm. in sort of Central Africa. It's an island off of the Nigeria, south of Nigeria and Ghana. And it's quite extraordinary because around the plantations are lush forests and you can see the biodiversity is very rich. But as soon as you see the plantations, it's just one tree as far as you mm-hmm. can see. And there's only a select amount of species that can inhabit these areas, but obviously in a natural rainforest you've got a wealth of different species that can live in there. So seeing something like that was quite extraordinary because you kind of go, oh wow, you've kind of just like removed loads of species home and only a couple could live in this palm oil plantation, which again they eradicate anyway because they don't want them there because they're trying to sell palm oil. And it's interesting, palm oil part of a rainforest, a palm oil tree part of a rainforest, looks quite cool, but when there are thousands of them all in a row, no, it just looks horrible and barren in its own way. It's weird. Mm-hmm. But we are quite conscious of it. We try to avoid things like Nutella a lot because I know that has palm oil in it. But sometimes I was in a cash and carry yesterday And next, there was a palm oil save the palm tree oil trees section. And right next to it was then a big, like a big pile of Nutella, which they were selling in bulk. And I'm like, well, that's not the right place to place this product, I don't think.
Not quite how it works, no.
No. But just so you know, a lot of this rainforest, a lot of the products that you can actually get from rainforest in terms of the material were things like toothpaste and shampoo, dog food, and granola bars, I found out as well.
Uh-huh. All of them quite high in palm oil.
I think so, yes. That's where they put all the palm oil. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, if you want to take some soy out of the beef food chain and put it into the human food chain, do you want two quick, excellent soy-based recipes?
Let's go for it.
I've come across recently. Number one is soy bacon, which is Spanish for I am bacon.
I am bacon, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, maybe I am still sick. Yeah. All you need to do, slice up some tofu, smoked tofu, get smoked tofu, slice it up super, super thin, dip it in soy sauce, and then bake it 200 degrees for about 10 minutes on each side, flip it halfway through, flip it after 10 minutes, bake it for 20 minutes total. And it tastes so similar to bacon when you have it in a sandwich with ketchup and brown sauce that it'll surprise you. And the other one is grated tofu, which I thought would be absolutely disgusting. But it's not. It tastes like chicken gyros. It's incredible.
Can I suggest maybe why? Because why? I think because grated cheese tastes really nice because it covers a larger surface area of your tongue.
I think that's it.
Is that what it is?
I think that's it. Yeah, because the problem with tofu is the inside of it's really soft and gooey and crap. It's horrible. So if you get rid of the inside of it, just have the outside of it, then it's really good. So all you need to do, grate some tofu and then fry it for about 5 minutes till it goes brown and add some spices. And it tastes genuinely like a chicken gyros.
Okay. Well, like I've got my dinner plan later. We've got a grater. We've got some tofu.
Excellent.
That's what we're going to have.
Congratulations to you.
Thank you. So, Will, I think, have you got a misconception corner for me?
I do have a misconception. Yeah, I'm going to lure you into misconception corner. And my facts this week, all three of my knowledge gaps that I'm filling in are all on the same theme, which is on the 28th of June, it will be the anniversary of the assassination of Franz Ferdinand, so the start of the First World War.
Ooh.
That's only in about 10 days' time. So we're doing First World War facts today.
That's exciting.
In order to test your knowledge. And all of these are also things that I teach to year nines. So if we get any listeners complaining, actually, that's wrong, then I've got quite a few years of kids that I need to go and apologize to.
Well, that's understandable. That's a lot of administration to work out.
So my misconception is, in the First World War, which weapon out of the big three weapons of the First World War, so rifle fire, artillery, big shells, cannons, essentially, and gas, which of those three do you think was the least deadly?
The
least likely to kill people. Yeah, not in terms of total numbers, but in terms of if you were affected by it, you were the least likely to die from it.
Okay, so that's quite a trick question, because my assumption would be, if you get a bullet through your head or through your body, I think, and also I think maybe in, was it 1913
here? Yeah, 1914 to 1918.
Okay, so in this time period, I'm thinking you haven't got much of a chance. One was gas. What was the other one again?
Mm-hmm. Artillery fire.
That's gonna show you shit if you got good aim. But if you were affected by that, your limbs are going to be pretty messed up amongst everything else. So I'm going to go with if you get gassed, maybe there is a way which if you escape it quick enough, like radiation from the Chernobyl disaster, if you were far away enough, you might be able to recover. And you're about to tell me that's wrong?
No, I'm about to tell you that's exactly right.
Oh, yeah. I got one.
The misconception is that gas really wasn't very deadly at all in the First World War.
Think
of a gas attack, a chemical attack, as being super, super deadly. Like the gas creeps over the trenches, gets into your lungs, kills you. So we're talking about gases like chlorine gas or tear gas or that kind of thing.
Okay.
And the fatality rate for gases in the First World War was about 7%, which means that of all of the people who were affected by gas in the First World War, 7% of them ended up dying.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But which then is not very many at all.
That's not very many, but how do you measure if someone's affected by gas?
As in injuries versus deaths. So if when they report to the field hospital, they say, what happened to you? If you're dead, you obviously don't reply.
Yep.
If you're alive, you say gas, or you have symptoms of a gas attack.
Okay, because what I was thinking is because it's funny you said, because the reason I asked that question is because if you're, for example, in an aeroplane, and you what's the percentage of people that survive aeroplane accidents? And actually, it's about 94%.
All right,
but it's more to do with how do you measure what an aviation accident is? Yeah, so if it's, for example, like a part of the wing sort of falling off, or an engine failure out of one out of four of them, and you still land the plane, they classify it as an accident, but no one's injured or dead or didn't even really notice. That's why I sort of went down that route.
aha. No, this is not just, this is casualties. So this is people who are knocked out of the war, essentially. They can no longer fight because their injuries are so severe.
I see.
And of those who were casualties of gas, so about 1.3 million people in the First World War,
it's quite a lot of people,
were a casualty of gas, which is a lot of people. About 22 million deaths overall. But of those 1.3 million casualties from gas, only 90,000 people were killed. The rest were all wounded or injured in some other way. And the reason why is because the point of gas in the First World War wasn't to kill people. The technology was very, very new at that point in time. So it originated from Germany, and some big chemical companies who still exist today, like Bayer or BASF, they were the ones who made this poison gas. And it just wasn't very deadly. The point of it was to get people to hide so that when you were, or to disable them so that when you were assaulting the trench, they wouldn't be able to shoot back at you. But that meant that it just didn't really kill that many people. It would blind you. It would make you cough up blood and mucus and all kinds of nasty stuff. It would make you vomit, but it generally wouldn't kill you. So then the question is, if it was not that deadly, why is it such a big deal when it comes to the First World War? Why do people think First World War, trench warfare, gas warfare? The reason why is because it was so terrifying. Because you didn't know when it was coming, because by the end of the war, they start to develop colorless gases that can seep into the trench without anybody seeing it.
Oh, God.
And it's the psychological terror of not knowing when the attack's going to come is the reason why it was so terrifying.
It's a bit like carbon monoxide.
Yeah.
In that sense.
Which we've spoken about before. Yeah. Yeah. It's exactly the same thing.
Did they leave post-it notes everywhere in the trenches?
They did not, because they hadn't invented them yet. No.
Ah, okay, fair enough. That's a good reason not to do that.
Yeah, so gas in the First World War, not that big a deal. But what it does lead to is gas masks. And what gas masks lead to is no beards in the army. The reason why you're not allowed to have a beard in the army anymore is because a gas mask doesn't fit over a beard.
So we wouldn't be allowed in the army unless we shaved our beards off.
Shave your beard off. You can have a moustache, because that can fit under a gas mask.
Ah, okay. But you can't have a beard. Yeah. Oh. Nope. Okay, Will, so we're in the main gap-filling area now. Mm-hmm. Aptly named. I'm going to do a quiz of you. Do you want to hear the title of the quiz?
I do want to hear the title of the quiz.
So the title of the quiz is, well, that's a weird place to live.
Okay.
Is the name of this quiz. Now, I don't know how good your memory is, but I'm going to give you four facts. And it might be worth, if you want to note these down.
Yeah, I shall, because my post-COVID brain is fogging over. Like,
I'll let you do it now.
In London.
Okay, Will, can you confirm that you have a pen or a pencil or any form of writing equipment? You could use your own blood. I don't mind. Toothpaste, whatever.
I'm not going to do that because I'm not a pervert. I have a 1.6 millimeter Bic crystal biro, which I
excellent.
Hope will suffice. And I have a piece of paper on it with a monkey on it.
Excellent. Yeah, I can see the monkey. Excellent. So you can do some doodling if you need to as well at any point of this if you get bored. So I'm going to tell you the facts.
So you've got high hopes for this section, then, do you?
I think so, yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, get your colouring pencils out because this bit's going to be crap.
Yeah, but I would also be quite pleased if they got their colouring pencils out being geographers, so
That is true. You'd like that.
Okay, so I'm going to give you four facts, and then after you write those down, then I give you four cities. If you would like to play at home, you can do the same as well. Obviously, pause the podcast here if you want to get some pen and paper, if you're that inclined and really want to. So the first fact is 80% of residents live underground.
80% underground. So Wimbledon Common.
Possibly.
Possibly.
It's a good guess. The second fact is shaped like an aeroplane is the next one.
Okay. I think I know what that one is.
Oh, okay.
Off the top of my head.
The third one is the dead outnumber the living.
Oh, God. For now.
Yeah, for the time being.
And
the fourth one is a town under one roof.
Town under one roof. Okay, so to confirm, 80% underground, shaped like an aeroplane, where the dead outnumber the living, and a town under one roof.
Correct. So what I'm going to do now, I'm going to give you the settlements or the place names, and you want to note those down, and we can go and... we can go through and see if we can match up the correct one. So what I'll do, actually, I'll give just the first the place name, and you've got to choose one of those four of what one you think it might be.
Right. Okay.
I think that's how it might work. this is a dry run. This is the real thing, actually, and I don't know how it's going to pan out.
This is not a dress rehearsal, Reece. We're straight in.
Okay, so the first place is in Australia, and it's called Cooba Pedy.
Cooba Pedy.
Yes.
Right.
Australians, P-E-D-Y. It's two words, yeah. Cooba Pedy.
Cooba Pedy. Right. So let me talk you through my thinking. Australia, what do we know about Australia? Two things. Number one, it has zero culture. And number two, it's too hot to live in.
I think we've managed to get free listens from Australia, so...
what they're all about. my abiding memory of Australia, actually, when we were driving through the streets of Australia, I can only remember seeing two things. One was sports pitches everywhere.
Okay.
And in between the sports pitches, all they seemed to have was dentists and sports pitches.
Right.
So
you would arguably you said they got bad teeth, but actually probably really good teeth.
No. Yeah. I mean, the complete inverse of Britain.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, no dentists around forever. And
literally the other side of the world.
Yeah.
So it's hot. So I'm thinking underground works. I'm thinking town under one roof also works. I'm thinking shaped like an aeroplane. I mean, the sun does do some weird things to the Australians, but I don't think it would make them that. I don't think so. Where the dead outnumber the living. I mean, possibly it could be a very small kind of community off in the wilderness where people have moved away from, but that, I don't know, that doesn't sound too interesting. So it's either town under one roof or 80% underground.
I need your answer, Will.
Okay, I'm going to go 80% underground.
You have got one out of four so far.
Yay! Congratulations. Ding, ding, ding.
So Cooba Pedy, it's what they call the opal capital of the world. And there's loads of opal gemstones there. And it's a really small Australian town of approximately 3,500 inhabitants, of which they live in these underground caves, or 80% of them do. And they call them dugouts. That's the name of them. Nice. It was founded about 100 years ago. And the story is there was a teenager who managed to find these gemstones. And all of a sudden, when he found them, they become a very popular place to move to mine them. But the thing with Cooba Pedy is that it's really hot. It's sort of in the middle of the outback, and it can get to 110 degrees Fahrenheit. So I think that's about 45 to 51 degrees Celsius. And that's not particularly seasonal either. It's most of the year. It can pretty get to that hot. And that the thing as well, hot. It's really warm. And the thing is, you don't really, what they wanted to do, they had, I think, to begin with settlements above the ground, and then AC was invented, and then it was too expensive to run. So they thought, what can we do here? We're going to build underground and sort of live in these underground caves because it's a lot cooler naturally.
Nice.
Which I think is quite cool. It's environmentally friendly, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess.
But what's interesting is down in these underground caves, they've got things like an outback bar and grill, a small, my favorite one, a small petrol station. which I don't know, which I quite like.
Okay. I wasn't expecting cars, if I'm honest.
Yeah, nor was I. But they've got hotels, churches, restaurants, and bars all underground, which I think is quite a cool city to visit. Yeah. But 80% of Coober-Pedy live in caves underground in the Australian outback in the desert area. It's quite cool.
Have you ever been to Australia?
Never, but I've got family in Melbourne, so I should be out there at some point. Yeah. But that's it's on my list of to-do places. Yeah.
Yeah. It's an interesting place. It's very similar to the UK in some ways and very, very different in other ways.
Okay. Yeah. Lack of culture, as you describe.
Well, I mean, let me justify that. Okay. Because there are listeners who are fuming at the moment, no doubt. I went on a rugby tour to Australia. So like I was already on a bit of a loser because like we went to rugby specific places, hang out with Australians who like rugby. And one place we went to was a place called Toowoomba, which is in Queensland, I think. And it's a bit of a farming place. And the people that we were billeted with were cattle ranchers. And the dad was a cattle auctioneer. And he spoke the entire time like cattle auctioneers do, just completely incomprehensible. Hey, you want to say, mate?
Yeah.
What? You want to say, mate? What? Okay. And we were just sat outside like having a beer. And all of a sudden their 12-year-old son comes riding in on the back of a massive bull, this huge bull with enormous horns. And we were like, why is he on the back of the bull? Is everything okay? Oh yeah, no, we gave that to him for his 10th birthday. That's his pet. What?
Just one question quickly. Was this a dream?
No, this is the thing. This is a real place. And then we were just talking to these people and one of them said, do you want to go and beat up some kangaroos? Sorry, what? Yeah, we just go and grab some kangaroos and tie them to a tree and punch them in the face. What are you talking about? So yeah, that's my impression of Australia.
Right.
Not the best, perhaps.
So not the cosmopolitan metropolis area. This is definitely rural outback village life.
This was very rural. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
So a unique cultural experience, I think.
Well, when I go to see my cousins in Australia, that's the first thing I'm going to bring up because I'm sure that's on the forefront of their mind of things to do in Australia.
Yeah, punch a kangaroo by a billabong. Absolutely.
Right. Do you want the second place?
Yes.
So you've got one which was 80% of residents of underground. So we've got three left. Mm-hmm. And now the next town is Colma, California.
Colma, California. Okay. Colma, California. This could go either way. I'm gonna hang on to Shape Like an Aeroplane for a bit because I think I know what that one is.
Okay.
Dead Outnumber the Living or Town Under One Roof. Colma, California. I mean, California could be anything. It's hot in the south and wet in the north. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to guess the Dead Outnumber the Living.
Oh, he's done it. He's got two out of four. Well, stuff in the dark. So in Colma, California, yes, there is a residential area where the dead outnumber the living. So do you want to know the ratio of dead to alive people?
This is going to be gross, isn't it?
It's 833 dead to one alive.
That's not okay. What?
So in this place, there's about 1.5 million dead bodies, but there are fewer than 2,000 living citizens there. And it's nicknamed the City of Souls. But what I quite like is that it's like a literal version of a ghost town. It's kind of how you imagine it, right? Because I know there's a lot of ghost towns in the States because of the gold mine rush and so on.
This is literally a ghost. But how do you get 1.5 million bodies? That's
crazy, isn't it? So the town is only 1.9 square miles. And it hosts about 17 or 18 cemeteries.
Okay. And do they just love it?
Well, there is a bit of a backstory to this. It links to the gold rush, actually. But so you know, there are some notable residents that have been buried there. So Levi's founder, Levi Strauss, is buried there. Mm-hmm. Bank of America founder, A.P. Giannini, and a baseball player called Joe DiMaggio. They're all buried there in this place called...
Joe DiMaggio, off of the Simon and Garfunkel song.
Yes.
Yeah.
It would be, of course. We need to go back to the 1800s gold rush to be able to kind of understand why this exists. So there was a huge amount of movement to San Francisco. It was a very small town, as you probably know, and due to the gold rush, it started to grow in size. But because of the amount of cholera disease that was occurring at the time, and also a lot of deadly and dangerous accidents that would happen whilst mining, there was a big problem with the amount of bodies that were piling up in San Francisco, and they actually couldn't account for it. So what they'd done, they started to bury lots of bodies around San Francisco, but it was becoming a little bit of a problem. They couldn't put like new developments and new plumbing, for example, in, so they had to exhume loads of graves and then move them exactly. Just so you know, Will is squirming his face at this. And they had to move them to a place called Colma. And interestingly, it's in 1914, so they all did it by foot as well. It was to carry dead bodies to Colma.
One under each arm.
But yeah, pretty much. Hopefully not disintegrated on the way there as well. So they moved them to one specific location in Colma, and then they've buried them all there, and that's become kind of the place where there are more dead than the living. And that's kind of what it's like, this tourist attraction is now. It's just south of San Francisco. It's not too far away. But it has one of my favorite, sort of city slogans, which you'll quite like. And it's called, "It's great to be alive in Colma," which I think is absolutely dynamite.
That's such a low bar as well. I love that.
Yeah.
It's right. It's good to be alive.
Yeah.
For once.
It's right on the nose, that one, isn't it? Which I quite enjoy.
It is. That's very good.
And you can make the other joke where it's the dead center of town as well.
Of course.
Okay,
which,
so you're
two... I still annoy everyone I'm in a car with by going, "You see that? That's the dead center of Duisburg." It never has been funny.
No, and it never will be, as much as you say it. It's like
that's the point.
It's like a joke on a fridge.
Exactly.
So
Thank you. I'm going to put that on my CV.
So you're two for four. And we've got two left. I've got a feeling you're going to get four out of four here.
Because
you think you know one of them.
I think I do.
So my next place is Brasilia, Brazil.
Back of the net. I know it.
So it is.
Brasilia is shaped like an aeroplane, isn't it?
It is shaped like an aeroplane. So I've just sent Will a picture for him to look at. But Brasilia is shaped like an aeroplane. What do you know about Brasilia? Do you know anything?
It's quite new, isn't it? Like, obviously, because it's shaped like an aeroplane. That's not just luck.
No, it's a planned settlement.
Lie along some ancient ley lines and it just happened to line up perfectly.
So Brasilia is the largest city in the world that did not exist at the beginning of the 20th century.
Oh, right. I didn't know that. So yeah. It's like the Milton Keynes of the Amazon.
Yeah, pretty much. Plastic cows and all that. Yeah. And probably a bunch of roundabouts that run through.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are a couple of, so it was built in 1956 as a way to get away from Rio de Janeiro being the capital of Brazil. I think there was always, like in Australia, there was a fight between Melbourne and Sydney to be the capital. So to defuse it, let's put it in Canberra. A similar thing happened in Brazil.
We've spoken about this before, haven't we?
I think so, yeah.
If you can't agree, then neither of you will have it.
And the same happened in Brazil. It was between Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo.
Right.
So none of you can have it. We're going to build one and put it in Brazilian further into the jungle, essentially. They would have had to cut down some
trees. And it's going to look like an aeroplane.
And it's going to look like an aeroplane. It's interesting why it's like an aeroplane. I've just sent Will the map of this. The airport is outside of the aeroplane, which I can't.
Which is an absolute missed trick, isn't it?
I know, right? But put it
in the cabin.
You think
surely,
so, wouldn't you?
Put it at the nose of the aeroplane.
But each of the sections of the aeroplane have different zonings. So it was kind of planned in that sense. So you've got, for example, along the fuselage, so along the center, you have actually the sort of the commercial district where there's lots of shops. So that's right. What the center bit is. So that's like the trolley of the aeroplane offering service throughout. At the back of the aeroplane, so I imagine where the luggage would be, is where the military is developed. Mm-hmm. And then kind of sort of like the wings of the aeroplane, both sides is where the residential area lives. And then in the center, sort of like the center of the wings, right in the middle, is where the government buildings are located. And that's pretty much all of Brasilia. But in front of the aeroplane, you've got a massive lake. And it's meant to have been designed that way because they have winds coming from the east to the west. And it's meant to naturally ventilate the city with cool air. So that's kind of the idea.
Right. That's a good idea.
Yeah. So that's why it's designed in that way. Specifically by this lake, is meant to naturally cool the whole of Brasilia.
But I can see one big problem here.
Yes, what is the problem?
In terms of the main roads, you've got one road going, what I presume is north to south. And mm-hmm. then the other road is extending through the wings. And so those two roads look a bit like a big D or like a bow, as in a bow and arrow.
Yes.
How do you get from the housing to the commercial district, for example?
I think there's roads that run through it. But I think, okay. like you say, that on that image, we'll tweet this image out so you can have a closer look. But yeah, I think that's like the main veins that run through, if they were, of a city, the main roads.
So everybody's going to be traveling along those main roads.
Pretty much.
I've played enough City Skylines to know that that is a recipe for disaster right there.
Absolutely. Particularly those sharp corners where there's going to be some clogs.
There are going to be clogs.
But yeah, so that it was designed by Lucio Costa, Oscar Neymar, and Roberto Bula Marx. They were the three designers of Brasilia. It's also UNESCO World Heritage site as well, due to architecture. Cool. So that leaves us then with one more left.
Town Under One Roof.
The Town Under One Roof, which I can just kind of just tell you because there's only one left here anyway.
can you give me some clues and see if I can figure out what part of the world we're talking about?
Okay, we are in the United States of America.
Okay, I'm going to guess we're in the USA.
Yes, we're in the USA.
Give me more cryptic clues than that.
Okay, so it's weather related.
Right.
And yeah, so weather related. So you are going to be probably hot or cold. Mm-hmm. And it's a coastal town. There's only mm-hmm. kind of one road in, one road out. It's a small port.
Okay.
And I can't think of any more clues to give you to maybe give it away.
Okay. Do you want to tell you my thinking at the moment? Yeah, I'm thinking somewhere up in Alaska. One road in, one road out. Cold place, like a frozen storage center up in the north of Alaska. So I know two places in Alaska, Anchorage and Juneau, okay. and neither of them are under one roof. So...
But you are. He's
I'm going to guess Alaska.
He's good, though. It is in Alaska. It's very good. It's actually not far away from Anchorage, but it's a place called Whittier.
Whittier.
And I looked at pictures of this when I was doing some research. It's unbelievable. It's just one 14-story building that used to be a military barrack that makes up the entire town of Whittier, and 220 people live in it.
Jesus.
And inside, you've got things again, like a police station, a gas station. Again, I don't know why it's a gas
station. You don't drive a car inside, people. There's fumes.
It has a church. And my favorite thing that it was kind of like bragging about has a video rental shop.
Oh, that's cute.
Quite nice. But I imagine, so basically, it's no real, it's not the only thing that's exciting about this place. It's just that everyone lives in one building. There's literally everyone. But it's just a town in Alaska. That's all it is, with one sort of like gray block of buildings. And it's like how you imagine any Alaskan town to be in the summer, gets 22 hours of sunlight, gets 20 feet of snow in the winter. There's nothing, and it's by the coast, and everyone works at that portal area. There's like, oh, and there's a small school inside, and that's kind of it. So it's just your regular town, but they all live in halls, essentially. It's just student life.
It is, yeah, student halls.
Yeah.
That sounds absolutely miserable.
Yeah, and it truly does sound miserable, but I would tweet a picture out of this place because it is quite extraordinary, just one building being for one town. And that is it. Mm-hmm. But it's got a fancy name. It's known as Whittier as the gateway to Prince William Sound is what its little tagline is. Which is,
I mean, that's, come on, they should take a leaf out of Colner's books and call it something like, well, at least you're not dead.
Yeah, right. Everything's in here.
You could be outside.
Yeah. I just want to summarize this. You've got 4 out of 4 on my quiz, which I titled, That's a Weird Place to Live.
Well, That's a Weird Place to Live. Well, I'm a weird person. Just to let you know, I have filled in my sheet, even with Whittier, Alaska, even though I didn't need to. And I don't know why I did that, but now I have a complete worksheet.
You have a complete worksheet. I would take that in and
put it in my files.
Yes.
Right. Use it to revise. So, as I said earlier, 28th of June is the anniversary of the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand. And I think it's quite a well-known story, but that's because I'm a history teacher and I think everything I teach is quite a well-known story. So how much do you know about it?
So are we actually talking about the event itself here?
The event itself, yeah.
So this is one of the things where actually I think I know some bits. So okay. Do you want me to say some of the bits I know already, or do you want to go through the story? Yeah.
No, tell me what you know already.
Okay, so what I know that the Archduke Ferdinand, how do you say his name? Well, that was bad.
Franz Ferdinand.
I'll just say Franz Ferdinand. Yeah, I'll go with that instead. It's a good band, by the way. I do know that much.
It is. Well, they're named after him.
Of course. So I know he was in a car when he was assassinated.
He was in a car.
And he was driving around, or he was being driven around, sorry.
He was being driven.
But there's something about where he went on a journey, went the wrong way, and there's something to do with the sandwich.
Misconception corner, ding, ding, ding.
Oh,
there's no sandwich involved.
Oh, damn it.
There's no sandwich involved. Oh, I'll tell you about that in a bit.
Okay.
Okay, so we got the gist of it, and that's what I thought people would have, kind of the gist of it, that we know that this guy was shot, and maybe he went the wrong way, and that's about it. But the specifics of the story are insane. We're in Sarajevo, which is in Bosnia, and Bosnia had just recently been captured by Austria-Hungary, which doesn't exist anymore, but at the time was basically Eastern Europe, Central and Eastern Europe. So all of the countries like Slovakia, Slovenia, Croatia, not Serbia, but Bosnia were all part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And they in 1908, they conquered Bosnia as well. And the idea is Franz Ferdinand's going to visit Sarajevo, capital of Bosnia, in order to go and just visit people and say hi and wave at the crowd. But the thing is, the Bosnians don't really like having been conquered. And the Serbians, who are just over the border, really don't like the Austrians because they don't want Austria to invade Serbia. They don't want Austria anywhere near Serbia. In fact, they don't want Austria in the Balkans at all. So Serbia is annoyed, Bosnia is annoyed, everybody's annoyed, and the Archduke turns up on the 28th of June. Now, 28th of June for us in the West and for the Austrians at this point in time is just any other day. For the Serbians, however, the 28th of June is by far and away the most important day in their calendar. It's their national day because it commemorates a time when they beat the Ottoman Empire in a battle in 1389 called the Battle of Kosovo. And it's the great Serbian victory. It's like their Waterloo or their Stalingrad. It's the great victory for them in their history. And so if you want to annoy the Serbians as the Austro-Hungarians, what you do is you go into their backyard and you start causing a nuisance on their national day. And that's exactly what Franz Ferdinand does, completely inadvertently. He doesn't know that this is a bad thing to do. He doesn't care that this is a stupid thing to do. So, he just turns up and waves at the crowds, essentially.
So he did this completely by accident, not knowing it was the national day, or did he have knowledge of that?
Well, he either didn't know or he didn't care. And I mean, the thing is with the Austro-Hungarian Empire, it's very much a mixture of they either don't know or they don't care. So, I mean, to give you an example of how much of a mess the Austro-Hungarian Empire is, in the 19th century in Vienna, they do create a parliament so that all the different peoples of the Austro-Hungarian Empire can come together. But at no point do they decide what language you're supposed to speak in the parliament. So that means you have debates going on in German, in Slovak, in Slovenian, Croatian, in Hungarian, all at the same time. It's a mess.
That is an
it's a complete mess.
Catastrophe.
It is. So it's completely possible that they just had no idea what they were doing. That is completely possible.
I feel sorry for the people that had to do the shorthand when they were having to write minutes for that meeting.
Just question mark, question mark, question mark. What they don't have an excuse about not knowing, though, is that the Serbian military intelligence is extremely powerful. The Serbian spy service is crazy powerful to the extent that they have spies basically everywhere in the Balkans. I remember the city that they're visiting, Sarajevo, isn't in Serbia, but Serbia wants it. And so Serbia are going to have spies there. Their spies are so powerful, for example, that in 1903, they launched a coup in Serbia and assassinated their own king because he wasn't giving them enough power. So Serb military intelligence have fingers everywhere, and they're definitely going to have people in Sarajevo. And so if you're not prepared for people to attack you in Sarajevo, then you just don't have any business being the ruler of a major nation.
Wow.
Because it's obvious that's what's going to happen.
Like that we're talking, like, so this is like the CIA of, this is the secret intelligence,
yeah.
And they're
just, yeah, the Serbian CIA.
Wow. Exactly. Okay. Yeah.
And so, of course, they have their fingers in Sarajevo, and of course, they hire some locals. They hire six people, and these six people are tasked specifically by the head of the Serb military intelligence, which they give themselves quite possibly one of the best names for any military intelligence ever, which is the Black Hand Group, which is just so good.
Is that a jazz band? It's like from Louisiana.
Old Jimmy Black Hands on the piano.
Yeah, right.
No, they're a terrorist group.
Oh, right, that's good. Okay, you don't want to mix those two up at all.
No. And do I have any other jazz terrorist jokes at this point? I'm trying to think of all the Cannonball Adderley, but it's not working.
Brand new sentence alert. Do I have any jazz terrorist jokes at hand?
I mean, there must be something with Cannonball Adderley, but I just can't get there. So you think of it yourself, listeners, and text us.
I thought you were asking me directly. I'm out already.
Nah, I got nothing. The Black Hand, they have six operatives working in Sarajevo, and their names are Mohamed Mehmed Basic, Vaso Cibrilovic, Nedjelko Cibrinovic, Cvjetko Popovic, Gabrilo Princip, and Trifko Grabej. So Mehmed Basic, Cibrilovic, Cibrinovic, Popovic, Princip, and Grabej.
Ladies and gentlemen, congratulations to Will for getting those names in. That's impressive.
Thank you. And I am aware I have a very slight speech impediment when it comes to pronouncing Ch. So hopefully that didn't make you throw up. So anyway, we got six people in there. So there's obviously terrorist operatives in Sarajevo. Let's do a quick bit of role play. You are the head of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand security detail.
Okay.
And you have to decide either you give him national troops from Vienna, which is going to cost a bit of money, and it might make you look a little bit oppressive because you're bringing Austrian troops into Bosnia, but you're going to save the guy in case anybody attacks. Or you can just put up local troops, 60 police officers from the Sarajevo police force, and hope nothing goes wrong. What do you do?
My hunch is to go with the former on that one. I would get the...
Wrong.
Oh, okay.
No.
Wait. Wrong as in, I know that's what didn't happen, but in hindsight, maybe, is something...
Well, hindsight's 2020 and we've both got glasses on. So
yeah, good point.
Yeah. No, wrong. They decide it would be too offensive to the locals to send in Austrian troops to protect the Archduke.
Okay.
Which is dumb.
That is dumb. Yep.
It's not intelligent. So what we end up with then is we've got a motorcade of about four cars, 60 police officers in the whole of Sarajevo, Sarajevo being the capital of Bosnia. It's fairly big, a couple of dozen thousand people, 60 police officers. 60 police officers wouldn't do one stand in an FA Cup final, let alone the whole of Wembley,
no.
Let alone the capital of basically enemy territory. So the car's driving along the quay, along the river, which is called the Miljajka River. And as it drives along the quay, it goes past a little cafe called the Mostar. And in the Mostar cafe, or just outside, you have Mohamed Mehmed Basic and you have Cibrilovic. Mehmed Basic has in his hand a bomb. He puts his hand into his pocket to pick up the bomb. He takes out his hand. He looks at the bomb. He decides he's not going to throw the bomb. He puts his hand back into his pocket and looks at Cibrilovic and goes, do you want to do it instead? Cibrilovic puts his hands into his pockets, pulls out a bomb and a pistol. He looks at the bomb. He looks at the pistol. He looks back at the bomb. He looks back at the pistol. He looks at Mehmed Basic and he says, let's just sod off. They do sod off.
They just run away.
They do not attempt the assassination. Yes.
But they were ordered to do so.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, that's they got scared.
They got scared. But that's what they signed up for, surely.
This is the level of slapstick terrorism that we're operating at. We are okay. Not far off the Marx Brothers here. Like, we're talking bladder on a stick level of idiocy.
Right, okay. There's a lot of idiocy already in this story, and that just adds more layers to it. So, idiot's take.
So the car keeps on driving down the quay. Nobody knows anything's happened because nothing has happened apart from two men have looked at each other and shared a moment and then sodded off. But as it goes past the quay, it goes past Cibrinovic. And Cibrinovic, he's not messing about. He's got the bomb in his pocket. He pulls out the pin on the bomb, chucks the bomb. It perfect arc lands right on top of the soft top of the folded down soft top of the open top car that the Archduke is driving in. But the thing is, Kaprilovic kind of over eggs his throw a little bit, and it doesn't land and stick. It lands and bounces off the Archduke Franz Ferdinand's car and blows up the car behind.
Oh no.
Franz Ferdinand was moments away from being blown up, but he just puts a little bit too much juice on the throw and it blows up the car behind.
Oh.
So Franz Ferdinand dodges death for the second or third time that day.
Is he not alerted by that, maybe?
He is alerted by that. He's not particularly chuffed. No, and we'll get on to that in a second. But Kaprilovic, all of them realized we're probably going to die today. So they'd all been given a cyanide capsule and they'd all been told as well, if you need to, just jump in the river and drown yourself, but do not under any circumstances get caught, because if you get caught, then this will be tied back to Serbia. And that means Austria will declare war on Serbia. And that means the whole world is screwed. So do not under any circumstances get caught.
Right. Okay.
So Kaprilovic knows this and he pops the cyanide capsule in his mouth and he bites down on it. And do you know what cyanide smells like and tastes like?
I don't know what it smells and tastes like. I know that it completely screws you up though.
It does, yeah. It kills you pretty quickly. It's almonds is what it tastes like.
Really?
So big taste of almonds goes into his throat. And the thing is, they're not quite the bitter almonds that they should be. Slightly rancid tasting. Mm. Problem is, they've had this cyanide for too long and it's gone off.
Oh,
and all
no.
It does is make him throw up.
Okay.
So he bites into this cyanide capsule, immediately throws up, chucks himself in the river. It's the middle of summer. The river is about 13 centimeters deep.
Oh my God, this is ridiculous.
So he chucks himself in the river, more splashes about like a child in a paddling pool.
Oh my God. So look, this is just a calamity central. What? No one can
really
get anything
is.
Right.
No, it's pure. It's like Charlie Chaplin at this stage. He's just floundering about, throwing up all over himself. And so the crowd come and grab him and they beat the absolute crap out of him. They just beat him to a pulp and then they give him to the police.
Okay, so the thing he was told completely to do anything else, but you need to avoid this only, he gets caught.
In his defense, he does try. But then in his prosecution, he doesn't try very well, does he?
No, not really.
Could have made sure the cyanide was good. You could have jumped in a deeper bit of the river.
The sell-by date, the cyanide's gone off, you know.
which before I came across the story, I didn't even know that was a thing. I just presumed it was good forever. But nope.
No, apparently not. It can go off, yeah.
Yep.
It doesn't better with age either.
No. So Franz Ferdinand isn't chuffed about this, but he decides we got to keep on with our itinerary. So they head down to the town hall. And at the town hall, they have a little reception and there's going to be some speeches. But Franz Ferdinand is pretty pissed. He's not happy that he's turned up somewhere and he's been almost assassinated. And so whilst the mayor is giving his speech, Franz Ferdinand interrupts him and says, "Mr. Mayor, I came here on a visit and I'm greeted with bombs. It's outrageous." Which I think is quite a good understatement.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think, yeah, it sounds like to me he was holding a lot back there, but also trying to be a bit polite.
He is trying to be polite, yes. You're right, it is outrageous. That is fair. But quite a sweet detail is that his wife, who's with him throughout all of this trip, called Sophie, the Archduchess Sophie, she just whispers something in his ear and he goes, "All right, I'm sorry, Mr. Mayor, carry on with the rest of your speech." Which is quite sweet.
That's very sweet.
Not now, Franz Ferdinand. Not now.
wrong moment.
So Franz Ferdinand is due to give the speech after the mayor, but he has to wait a bit because his papers were in the car behind. And by the time they turn up, they're all covered in blood. So he picks up his papers and he kind of mops them down a bit and gives his speech. And then they have the reception and they decide, what do you do next? And I'm going to put you back in charge of the security detail.
Okay.
You can either carry on the visit and put on a brave face, or you can wait for bodyguards to get there from the National Guard, from the army.
Okay. So
what do you think you should do?
So you've given me a choice again, and I know what the sensible option should be, and it should be the latter of what you said. You should get the bodyguards there.
Yep.
And did that happen?
Nope.
Of course not. It's a movie now.
It is. But the reason why is in itself absurd. The governor of the district, that everybody agreed, yeah, let's wait for the bodyguards. But the governor of the district said, I'm going to veto that because the thing is, they don't have enough time to go and get changed into their dress uniforms, and you can't possibly have bodyguards for the Archduke not in their dress uniforms.
No, fair enough. That's really important. In the time of crisis,
it would be outrageous.
Absolutely be outrageous. And it's already outrageous, as Franz Ferdinand himself has already said. You don't want to make it
worse.
Let's
not compound it. No. So they just decide, no, let's carry on.
Just keep going to the headwind.
But Franz Ferdinand decides, we're going to change the itinerary here, though, because people have gone to hospital from this explosion. It blew up the car. It killed a couple of people. There's about 20 people injured or wounded who've been taken to hospital. So I want to go to the hospital and I want to make sure they're okay. So they change the itinerary. Now, the driver doesn't know the local area and he doesn't have his assistant with him because the assistant has gone to the hospital to help out there. So what that means is that as they're driving back down the same road that they came up, the first driver takes the wrong right turn at the Latin Bridge, which is one of the bridges over the river. The second driver follows him, and the third driver, which is the driver of the car containing the Archduke, follows him as well. They all three of them take the wrong turning.
Oh.
But they realize they take the wrong turning at exactly the moment that the Archduke stops on the corner, and the driver starts to reverse, and as he starts to the reverse, the car stalls.
Oh no.
And they have to hop out and wind up the engine, and that's going to take a couple of minutes. Now, on this corner, there is indeed a cafe, which I think you remember.
Yes.
And the name of that cafe is Schiller's Cafe. And after the failure of the bombing, the other three assassins, Popovich, Grabez, and Princip, they basically decide to give up. They think, if he's got through three people already, it's not our day. There's going to be massive security. They're going to put the city on lockdown. There's no way that we're going to get through. So Popovich and Grabez kind of melt into the back streets. But Princip, who knows Sarajevo well, he's lived there for a number of years. He's only just been thrown out of the gymnasium 2 years previously because he's only 19 years old. Mm-hmm. So he's only just been expelled from school for his anti-Austrian sentiments, which sounds like he was involved in kind of protests and stuff. No, he would go around with a pair of knuckle dusters just punching people in the face if they said anything good about the Austrians.
That's enough to get you expelled from school.
That'd get you kicked out. I think bang to rights there.
Yeah, absolutely. Pretty much.
But he decides he's not going to melt into the back streets. He's going to hang around a bit and see what happens. And so he heads over towards the cafe and he doesn't buy a sandwich and he doesn't buy a cup of coffee. I'll get back to those in a second.
Yes.
All he does is he just stands outside and as part of the crowd. And he realizes as the first car goes past and turns the corner, hang on a minute, where are they going? And then the second pass goes past and turns the corner and it starts to slow down. And then the third car pulls up and stops and stalls. And he looks in the car and who does he see but Archduke Franz Ferdinand, the target of the whole thing. And he realizes not only is the Archduke there, but he's stuck. And there is nothing the Archduke can do. So he doesn't need to take a shot from outside the cafe. He can take his time by walking slowly up to the car and stepping into the footwell of the car and shooting the Archduke from point blank range. So he fires two bullets. The first bullet goes into the Archduke's jugular vein and severs it. And the second bullet hits the Archduchess in the stomach and she falls unconscious immediately and the Archduke falls unconscious on the way to the hospital. And they're both dead by 11:30, by within half an hour.
Wow.
So it is purely because they took the wrong turning. And the reason why they took the wrong turning is because the bomb had bounced off the back. And the reason why the bomb had bounced off the back of the car is because the car was still driving with the first two assassins not having assassinated him just because they got scared. It's a series of coincidence upon coincidence upon coincidence, all of which results in the Archduke being shot.
Wow. That's quite incredible. Like, it's like the butterfly effect, isn't it, in that sense?
Yeah, absolutely. It is any one of those decisions going ever so slightly differently. You put the Archduke's car second instead of third in the motorcade, and he's not assassinated.
Yeah. Oh man.
Any of those decisions could have gone that way.
And the fact that what a time to stall a car. I've stalled it on a hill. I've stalled it up to a roundabout and I wasn't assassinated. So
I've never stalled it carrying the second most important member of the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
No. That's like stalling your convertible car with the president in the back.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's always like running out of petrol at the lion enclosure in Longleat or something. Yes. It's like, it's just a bad look. Yeah. So what happens to them? All of them are sent to jail. Prinship sent to jail, and he dies in 1918 of tuberculosis at the age of 23. And funnily enough, he's buried in a chapel called the Heroes Chapel in Sarajevo. He's a bit of a national hero in Serbia, which is...
He wasn't buried in Colma, California.
He was not, no. And the thing is, the reason why it ends up leading to the First World War is Austria realized that Serbia is obvious to blame here, because Serbia have been helping these Bosnian terrorists out from the beginning. So Austria blames Serbia, and they declare war on Serbia a month later on July the 28th. And the thing is with Serbia is they have a big brother, and that big brother is called the Russian Empire. And Russia and Serbia are still to this day very, very closely linked. And so if you declare war on Serbia, then Russia will declare war on you. And so if Russia declares war on Austria, then that means Germany, who are allied to Austria, are going to declare war on Russia. And if Germany declares war on Russia, then that means France and Britain, who are allied to Russia, are going to declare war on Germany. And so because of this massive alliance system where Europe split completely down the middle.
Really?
And the idea behind this alliance system was, there's no way that we're going to go to war here, because war would just be too deadly. You can't have war between Germany, France, Britain, Russia, Austria, everybody, because what, like 20 million people would die, and we'd destroy the old world and create a whole new way of existence and invent new machinery that would kill everybody forever. Yeah, whoops.
Hey, whoops-a-daisy.
Sorry about that. So because of the alliance system and because of the spark that lights the bonfire, that's how we end up with the First World War.
Wow. What a string of events. Yeah. I think that's quite incredible, though. The alliance system is mad to me. And then we mentioned it before, but how Eurovision is maybe trying to bring that all back together so we're all friends of one another.
Yeah, which just makes so much more sense.
Yeah.
Like, if you're going to entwine countries with one another, do it in a way that doesn't lead to the First World War, maybe.
Yeah, maybe it's a pretty good idea.
And so, I mean, the story is, of course, ludicrous. It's absurd. At every single stage, you couldn't possibly make it up. But there is a detail that was made up, which is the thing about the sandwich.
So what is that about? Why do I assume he had a sandwich or something? I don't understand why I think that's a piece of knowledge. It's not, though.
It's because it's a good story. It's a really fun story that he gives up and goes and have a sandwich. And for some reason, I always thought it was a Gorgonzola sandwich. I don't know why I thought it was a Gorgonzola sandwich.
I think it's quite a middle-class sandwich, I think.
I think that's why.
Yes.
That's what it is. Yeah. But it's, it's from a novel in 2001. It was written by an author from Brazil who just invented this detail. It was kind of like a Forrest Gump type novel where a guy keeps on turning up in all these crazy scenarios. And one of them is he happens to be next to Gavrilo Princip when he's eating the sandwich. But it was in the novel in 2001. That was then picked up for a documentary in 2003 called Days That Shook the World, which if you've been to school in the last 20 years, you have doubtless seen. I've shown it every single year.
Yes.
And it's from that documentary that it's then spread to be in the public consciousness. But no sandwiches.
The media again, getting it wrong. So we're at number time now.
Fantastic news.
Okay, just want to tell the listeners, we just tried that before and Will came out of a very sort of monotonic response of, whatever.
Let's do it. Come on then.
Okay, so the number is, which you know already, is 200,000.
200,000.
And this is very vague, Canada.
200,000 Canada. Okay. Oof, right. 200,000 people in Canada live
under a roof.
Under a roof.
No, it's not that.
No, what am I thinking of here? There's something in Canada where some stupid proportion live within about 50 miles of the American border. So I'm thinking 200,000 people live further than 100 miles on the American border, something like that.
That's a really good, really good guess. What you just reminded me, it's pretty not right, by the way. It's a really good guess, though.
It's but not that good, then.
But you've reminded me that actually, like, there's one place in the United States where you can travel south into Canada. Do you know where it is?
Ah, yes. Yeah, it's over near Vancouver, isn't it, on the West Coast?
No, it's not. It's in the... Isn't it? No, it's the Michigan area, I think.
Ah, right.
So we're in
Detroit. Where the Great Lakes kind of... fold in on everything.
Yeah. Right. So in Detroit, you can go south into Canada. It's the only place in the States you could do that. No, that's not the answer. The extra clue, by the way, is kilometers. So the measurement is actually kilometers.
200,000 kilometers in Canada. Now, 200,000 kilometers is the kind of figure that means nothing to me.
Okay.
You could tell me that the distance between Paris and Rome is 200,000 kilometers. You could tell me the distance between the Earth and the Moon is 200,000 kilometers, and I believe you both ways. I don't. So I'm going to guess there is, if you lined up every Canadian geese in a row, it would stretch for 200,000 kilometers.
You know what? You could go and try that yourself and just see if that's true and make that your life's work. But no, the actual answer is it is the length of the Canada coastline added all together.
Okay.
Is 200.
That sounds long.
That is very, very long. So the exact amount is 202,080 kilometers. To give you a little bit of context, so this distance is so long that walking a little over 15 kilometers per day would take over 30 years to complete.
Okay. And do you know the circumference of the Earth? How many times around the Earth are we going?
Oh, I don't know that, but I think, you know what's really weird? I think I have that statistic here. But not for Canada. I have it for the country of the second longest coastline in the world, bizarrely. I'll get to there. Yeah, so Canada is the country of the longest coastline in the world. And do you know what country might be the second longest coastline in the world? Hazard a guess what it could be.
So I always thought that Norway had the longest country in the coastline in the world. I'm going to guess Norway is the second longest.
You're absolutely correct. It's Norway. And it has a coastline of 83,000 kilometers, which is the second longest in the world. And do you know why that has the longest coastline in the world?
Because of the fjords, I'm guessing.
Correct. Yeah. So, and Canada's very similar natured in that sense, where it has a lot of coastlines because there's lots of lakes and further north, there's like tens of thousands of lakes in Canada, and all of that contribute to a huge amount of coastline. But Norway, in that sense, is because of the fjords. With the fjords, I think, and with Norway, it's in a straight line. It would circle the Earth's equator over two times if you stretch all the coastline out. Yeah. So
okay. Right. Because I was thinking the circumference of the Earth is something like 35,000.
Something like that. Yeah. I don't know the exact number. But doing a quick conversion, that's like 4.5 to 5 times around the equator for Canada. Then you'd have to. So that's a little bit of like meaning onto that sort of number.
Yeah.
You'd have to walk around the Earth that many times.
Flipping long way.
It's a really long way.
A lot of coastline.
It really is. Yeah. But the shortest coastline within Canada out of all the provinces is Yukon, because that hasn't got much. I think it's only in the north where it has as a coastline. And the one with the longest coastline is Newfoundland and Labrador, because that's over in the east. Right. It's like Halifax area and there's lots of coastline there as well. But out of the total population of Canada, which is 35.7 million, only 7 million people live at or near coastal areas, which is quite weird. Considered as the longest coastline.
Yeah, and considering Vancouver is on the sea.
Yeah, no, exactly.
So that must account for a good chunk of that.
Yeah, and what it kind of exposes is that actually the most of this coastline can be found sort of in northern territories in the north and in the east, where there's hardly anyone anyway, because it's cold and horrible and no one wants to live there, apart from the Nunavuts that live up there. It's pretty barren, and that's where most of the lakes are. There's no development up there. But that's where most of the coastline can be found. But this is kind of like I hope the pop filter worked on that one.
That was a Mix-a-Lot style butt. That was enormous.
It was, because what's coming next is a gateway into actually what I wanted to talk about.
Here we go.
And my question is, how do you measure a coastline?
Ooh, from space.
Which would be the modern way to do it these days? Do you mean like you being 6'9" or whatever? Is that what, just look down?
Stand from up and peer. Exactly. Yeah.
I suppose it would be from space now. But actually, there have been many methods of way people have measured coastlines. But how, like, if you were on the ground, boots on the ground, and let's say, for instance, you could then measure a coastline, what would be your methodology? How would you go around it?
I mean, the classic geography field work is just get one of those meter rule wheelie things and walk that for 4 times the circumference of the Earth.
Pretty much. Yeah. But it's so that's the thing. So you said you get one of those meter rules. So that means you'll be measuring the coastline in meter intervals. So let's say, for example, now, I want you to imagine Great Britain, Let's say, for example, that you measure Great Britain's coastline using only 25 straight lines. That's how you could measure the coastline. Okay. And then again, so if you measured it that way, but then I said, right, now you measure it using meter intervals.
Okay.
What would the result of those two outcomes be? Would they be vastly different or the same?
Yeah, I would imagine they'd be enormously different because you're going to chop off huge patches by reducing the what's the word I'm thinking of? Not pixel density. Resolution, by reducing the resolution.
Yeah, exactly.
You're going to chop off huge distances.
Yeah, so if you kind of like zoomed in the scale, the coastline length would change as a result. So what we're discussing here is something called the coastline paradox, and it's a real thing. Actually, the coastlines all around the world effectively are of infinite length.
Right. They're like fractals.
Yeah, I'm glad you've said the word fractals because that's what I have on my notes. They are exactly fractals. Do you know what a fractal is? Mm-hmm. To tell the boys and girls.
Yeah, it's, I couldn't draw you one because that would be impossible. Like, I can describe what they look like, but I don't know how they're derived. It's kind of a mathematical representation of something where the further you zoom in, the more it keeps expanding. And you zoom into infinite resolution and it keeps on expanding infinitely. You can zoom in forever.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. So, and the coastline itself is fractal in that sense. So essentially what you do, you have a shape where you have a finite amount of area within that shape, but the perimeter of that shape is effectively infinite.
Right.
Which is where the coastline paradox is most famously linked to, these fractals. So calculating the length of the coastline, it can vary. So for example, if you measured the Australian coastline with a 500 kilometer straight line, it would be 12,500 kilometers in length. However, the CIA fact book, I don't know why they're measuring it, puts it at double that, at 25,700 kilometers. It all comes down to the length of measurements you would use to measure a coastline. So this was first theorized by someone called Lewis Fry Richardson in 1951. And I like the way he came across this. So this was a way to explain why Spain and Portugal came up with different values of their border length.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So you had to find a way to, why is this happening? Yeah. Because obviously they have a disagreement somewhere on this line. Mm-hmm. But you could even, you could even go down to the size of a water molecule. But this would mean that the coastline is effectively infinite. But the area of, let's say again, Australia would be finite but have an infinite parameter. But like you say, this is all because the coastline shapes are called fractals, where if you keep decreasing the scale, the coastline length increases in length. And that can just go on forever. Right. Yeah. That's the coastline paradox. Every single coastline around the world is of infinite length.
But they're not, but they are.
But they're not, but they are. Yeah.
Have you ever seen a fractal generator?
No.
So my dad did maths at university and has umpteen master's degrees in maths. And when I was growing up, we had quite a lot of computers in the house. Mm-hmm. And my dad has a abiding interest in maths, and so he always, one of the first things he would load onto the computer after Prince of Persia was a fractal generator. And what it is, let me just set you up for an excellent evening. What you want to do is get yourself either a big bottle of red wine or multiple malt beers. Mm-hmm. You want to get yourself Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, and you want to turn off every single light in your house except for your computer screen, and just pop on a fractal generator, and bam, 45 minutes will pass, because it just infinitely plays you a fractal, zooming in and changing color. And it is the most psychedelic thing you could possibly ask for.
Sounds like something I want to have as a motion screensaver on my computer.
Yeah, it is absolutely. It is absolutely that kind of thing. So like my 6-year-old brain was just monging out on that for hours at a time.
Just reminds me, do you know when a DVD player always went on to sort of like sort of screensaver mode, and the DVD side would ping around the screen? It never hit the corner. It never hit the corner. And I think that's an infinite
conspiracy.
Maybe.
Okay.
I was going to go with it's a mathematical thing that can never hit the corner of any screen, but maybe it is a conspiracy.
Now let's stick with conspiracy.
I prefer that.
Yeah. Okay, so my number time this week is carrying on the theme of the First World War, which is a clue. And the number is 3 years. And the follow-up clue is the British royal family. 3 years in the British royal family.
Is it the amount of time that they ignored that the war was actually happening?
You're not far off.
Oh, really? That was...
Let's put a pin in that idea and I'll give you my second clue, which is it took them 3 years to do something.
Oh, really? Okay. It took them 3 years to...
In fact, let me narrow it down. It took them 3 years to change something.
Did it take them... this is going to... I'm going out on a limb here. Did it take them 3 years to change the alert level to serious or something like that?
Not quite.
We're on code yellow. And oh, right. Now it's code red. Like, yeah,
should
we knew
probably
that.
Turn it up a little bit.
Yeah, right?
Not quite, no. It was... They changed something less to do with the day-to-day running of things, but more constitutionally fundamental.
Oh, okay. So is this like... Is this litigious?
Not quite.
Oh, you're going to have to feed me some more here because I'm really struggling.
Okay. When Prince William and Prince Harry served in whatever parts of the armed forces they served in, which is the kind of thing that I should probably know as a history teacher, but then I'm also a big Republican, so...
Yeah, right.
I refuse to even sing the national anthem. That's how pathetic I am. So when they served in the armed forces, do you know what they had as on their name tags?
So it's not going to be, is it not going to be royal or something like that? I don't know, actually.
It's not royal, no. They had the name of the royal house, which is the House of Windsor.
Oh, okay.
But what my number time is it took them 3 years in the First World War to change the name to Windsor from the name that they had before. And the original name of the British royal family was Saxe Coburg und Gotha.
Is there a potential problem here? Because the fact that you don't have an alliance with Germany and you're going against the Germans.
It's not a good look.
It's not the best look.
It's not a fantastic look.
No, it's not a great look whatsoever. That's sus.
For king and country, gentlemen, for king and country. Well, do you mean the king who is German?
If we're playing a game of Among Us, I think I'm calling that one out as sus.
little bit sus. Yeah. So the reason why is because the British royal family was German at this point in time. They were descended from the House of Hanover, of course. And Kings George I through, I'm pretty sure III, grew up speaking German. They didn't speak English as their first language. So 100 years previous, the kings of England were properly German. But Britain declares war on Germany in 1914 for invading Belgium, and they don't change the name instantly. It takes them 3 years. It takes them until the 17th of July, 1917.
It's not happened for such a long time, okay? Does that mean someone says, like, they suddenly realise and went, oh shit, we need to change that if we're going to do this? Like,
I think that's it. Yeah, they just kind of realised, are we still Germans? Yes, we are still definitely Germans. Should we change that we're Germans? Yeah, we should probably change that we're Germans. And so the imagination it took to come up with their new name was absolutely nil because they did this, sat in Windsor Castle, and they thought, what should we call ourselves? Windsor. Yeah, Windsor.
Decision to whatever name to choose took about 30 seconds, didn't it?
About 30 seconds.
It could have been sent an email, couldn't it? That meeting.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So they call themselves Windsor after Windsor Castle, and they're not the only people though to change their name because of the First World War. Have you seen The Crown, the Netflix show The Crown?
I have not. No, but it is on the list actually.
I love it. And I hate the monarchy. I think it's a terrible idea. I think it's frankly quite embarrassing, but I love The Crown because you just see how big an idiot every single member of the royal family is. It's hilarious.
Excellent.
But one of the main characters in the early seasons is a guy called Lord Mountbatten, who was the Queen's cousin and was Prince Charles's, I guess, not really patron, but more kind of, he was a guiding figure in Prince Charles's life.
Okay.
And shall I spoil it for you?
Go on.
Nah, I'm not.
No?
Yeah, okay. But spoiler alert for The Crown here, if you haven't seen it. I mean, it is British history. Like, it's, to be fair, but he was blown up in 1979 by the IRA. He was out fishing on his boat off the coast of Ireland, and he's blown up by the IRA, which is...
How? I want to know how.
They just put bombs on his boat and detonated them. I mean, it's just that straightforward.
Did he not notice them when they got on?
He didn't notice them. No, he was too busy
fishing,
being posh and inbred.
No, okay, yeah, well, yeah. They are two barriers to noticing bombs on a boat, to be fair.
They are, yeah. But his dad, not the first Lord Mountbatten, was called Lord Battenberg. But he realised, Battenberg, a little bit German, let's change it. And so they could take Battenberg, which means Batten Mountain, turn it into Mountbatten.
Why didn't I thought it would be Mr. Kipling?
Mr. Kipling, I thought I had a joke there about Mr. Kipling being a traitor to the British in the First World War by sticking to his Battenberg guns.
Oh, that's good though.
Can I do that? Yeah, no, Mr. Kipling isn't that patriotic. He's a famous German sympathizer, and that's why he stuck with Battenberg. Yeah. So
excellent, excellent stuff.
Yeah. I got a couple other things that were renamed in the First World War.
Go on then. Yeah.
Do you know what St. Petersburg was renamed to?
Isn't there a Russian name which is begins with L?
I ended up as Leningrad, but in between it's Petrograd.
Petrograd.
So it goes from St. Petersburg, yeah, to Petrograd, which is Russian for St. Peter's City.
Right.
And then is renamed Leningrad in 1922.
See, Petrograd is a map on one Call of Duty multiplayer game somewhere.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, makes sense.
Good. I'm glad that you can access this podcast on some level.
Yeah, right. Doesn't matter how I get there, I know. Pick up some bits on the way. It's never linear.
German Shepherds are renamed. Dog, do you know what they're renamed to?
British Shepherd.
No, Alsatians.
Oh, of course, Alsatians.
Yeah, of course. So they're named after the French region of Alsace, which the Germans wanted.
Okay.
So Alsatians. Uh-huh. In Australia, they renamed Berliner Donuts to Kitcheners because Lord Kitchener was in charge of the war.
And the kitchen.
And the kitchen, yes, including the sink. Do you have any other things being renamed in wars?
I'm interested to know do towns get named renamed in wars?
Not as often as you'd think.
Okay.
No. I mean, sometimes they get renamed after war heroes, but not that often.
I imagine...
I can tell you about a town that wasn't renamed in a war, which is in Canada. The town of Svastika, Ontario, were told that they couldn't rename themselves in the Second World War. They
had
their appeal turned down. Nope, you're sticking as Svastika.
That sucks if you're from that town. Have they changed it recently, though?
I don't think they have.
Oh, my God.
They just stuck to their guns.
We came first.
They did. They picked it before the Nazis did. Back to renaming stuff.
Yes.
In the Iraq War, a couple of things were renamed.
Hills.
Quite famous.
Deserts.
Not hills. No.
Rivers.
Let me give you some clues here, actually. Let's see if we can figure this out. They were named by the Americans because the French and the Germans refused to join the coalition to invade Iraq. What big French and German things do you know are enjoyed by Americans on a daily basis?
Beer?
Not beer. Good thinking, but not beer.
Pretzels?
Not pretzels, not so much. No, I'll give you a clue. One of them... Well, okay. If I were to give you a hot dog,
Frankfurter,
what would you have on the Frankfurter? Wasn't renamed, funnily enough.
Okay.
But what would you have on that hot dog?
You have ketchup.
Ketchup, but that's not German. What kind of German things would you have on the hot dog?
You would have mustard, mayonnaise. Mustard?
Mayonnaise, funnily enough, is Spanish. It's named after Mahon, which is in Ibiza, I think.
Okay. Mustard?
Not German. No, think more German.
God. What do Germans have? Like curry sauce?
Even more German than that. Get more racist for me, Rhys. Channel your inner Brexit.
Sauerkraut.
Sauerkraut, exactly, yes.
That's how you access that chamber in my brain.
There you go. Yeah, just descend into your inner Farage.
Yes.
and all you see there, bloody kraut.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So that's the name's renamed sauerkraut.
Yeah, and they renamed it Liberty Cabbage.
Oh.
Which is good. And nice. So French fries were therefore, of course, renamed. Can you guess what they renamed French
Liberty fries?
Close, freedom fries.
Freedom fries. So, oh, he's got an alliteration there with you.
Exactly. Okay, that's all for this week. If you want to hand in your work to Reese, then please email it to gapsinknowledge@outlook.com or get in touch with us on Facebook, where just search for Gaps in Knowledge Podcast and we will appear.
Yeah, and when I finish marking the work, I'll give it back to Will, obviously. And if you want to get some peer marking review, you can get in contact with us on Twitter at Gaps Podcast. And also you can find our YouTube channel to do some final review of your work at the Gaps in Knowledge Podcast YouTube channel. Just search us there and you will find us. Will, I just have to say one thing. Now I know about World War One. Can I now say that I could do a thesis on this? Am I well-knowledged on this now?
I think we've sufficiently filled in some gaps.
There's a lot of World War One gaps that were filled. Thank you for that. And hopefully we'll see you in 2 weeks if none of us get COVID again.
Fingers crossed. I don't intend on going on another honeymoon to Iceland. I do intend to go back to work. You'll be very glad to hear.
I'll be very glad to hear that as well. But yeah, thank you very much for listening. And we will see you in 2 weeks. Okay, shall we go for the intro?
Yeah.
Welcome to the Gaps in Knowledge Podcast. I'm Reese, and I'm a geographer that knows nothing about history.
I'm Will. I'm a historian who knows very little about geography.
And in this week's episode, I fall over felling of what the fuck? Okay, let's do it again. It makes sense. Actually makes sense, but it's so fucking weird to read. Let's do it again.
Okay. Well, you wrote it.
I did write it. I did like the emphasis the wrong way round. That's why it felt weird to say. We'll start again.
Right.
Yeah, whoops. Welcome to the Gaps in Knowledge Podcast. I'm Reese, and I'm a geographer that knows nothing about history.
I'm Will, and I know nothing about geography.
Are you a historian as well?
I am. And also, I did get 100% on this week's quiz.
You did, actually. So that's very true.
Chuffed to bits. Let's try that again.